It's Sunday, which means it's time for Viewpoint Presents with Malcolm and Michael Johns. Each week, we bring you the top global and national news stories presented with facts and top-tier analysis, all from a perspective rooted in America's founding principles. Join us in defending our great nation and American liberty. Now, here's Malcolm and Michael with the week's top stories.
Here we are. Election 2020 is full steam ahead now, my fellow Americans, as we now get ready for, well, an election of our lifetimes. Welcome to the show here. It is Malcolm along with Michael Johns on Viewpoint Presents. We're happy to have you with us on the inaugural program of this unprecedented second hour of our Viewpoint brand, and excited is anything that you're here with us to launch this thing. And so first up is election and COVID. I mean, nothing is more important right now than that. That is one of the big stories and probably the biggest in our nation. Michael, I think we start with the fact of what makes this election different. And you were on a roll, so I think we get you to pick it up right there. And so what do you think makes this election different?
Well, I mentioned one of the most graphic differences is that the country has evaluated and developed very strong opinions, positively or negatively, about this president. Encouragingly for the president, despite some polls that show him down nationally and in some key states, most recent Rasmussen poll, pretty reliable polling agency in my view, has his approval rating about 49%. That's a little higher than it has been traditionally on average over the last 3+ years. So I don't really see any sign of erosion in his base. And I see any degree of enthusiasm really mounting behind Biden. I think, you know, for the purpose of these polls, people that say they're going to vote for Biden are either just against the president, and that's the option that's presented to them, or, you know, even afraid to say they support the president, and they do. But the enthusiasm gap, which has been measured here now pretty regularly over the last few months, shows that those individuals who indicate that they support the president do so with vastly greater amounts of enthusiasm than those who say they intend to vote for Biden.
Yeah, and then there are those people who don't vote at all. You know, they just stay home. And that, of course, if that's a Biden or a Democrat or someone to the left of the aisle, that becomes, in essence, a vote for Trump, right?
Yeah, tens upon tens of millions of Americans who never show up to vote for whatever reason. I mean, they're not engaged. They don't understand the significance of it. They don't believe their vote counts. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of reasons. Yeah. I mean, a lot of cynicism about the process. I discourage that. Every vote does count. I mean, certainly you can go back and look at this 2016 race and, you know, had Trump voters not shown up in a few states in significant number, could very easily gone the other way and didn't because of that.
Well, a perfect case of that is the 2018 midterm, Michael, right there. I mean, let me just say it. Yeah. I mean, had Republicans got out and supported the president, they would not have won the House of Representatives back. We wouldn't have had an impeachment thing. We would have changed history. You know that.
Well, and unfortunately, I think, Paul Ryan, who was Speaker of the House back in 2017, January 17, when the president took office, was it almost a veiled sort of resistance leader himself, in the sense that he did not move with any degree of aggression to support the Trump agenda, found a lot of excuses, some of which the Trump White House accepted for not moving forward on key platform planks, the most critical of which was the border wall, centerpiece of this president's election, really, in 2016. Nothing on which I believe there's a clear mandate for this president to be executing. And yet, widely known, we have, you know, some construction moving in the right direction, but, you know, not with the urgency if you had the entire country behind it. And I think a lot of voters who turned out in 18 sort of looked at the ineffectual nature of some of those Republicans in the House who followed Paul Ryan, not the president, and didn't really see any degree of accomplishment for him in those 2 years.
Everything has been a battle. I mean, you say the wall, everything has been a battle for this administration. and furthermore has been a battle for the American people to get out from under all of this, which really has complicated things, because it's bad enough the challenges are as great as they are, right? But I mean, on top of all that, you have all of these severe political games being played, all at the duress and really to pull the country backward instead of forward. And so we're not getting the traction out there. I think that we'll come back to more of the election 2020 just ahead, because there's a lot to talk about here and with Biden and Trump and all that. But let's overlap this right now. And as I want to bring in the COVID conversation, Mike, talk about the coronavirus. And, you know, a lot of people thought that would be almost in our rearview mirror by now. There was a lot of talk early on about, okay, when summertime comes, this virus doesn't like the heat. It's going to kind of go away. The numbers are going to come down. And none of that has happened. It's kind of fueled up. But the bigger problem is the numbers that are being talked about, the numbers that are being reported on, are not accurate at all. And so all of that is fueling this unrest in this media propaganda campaign. The fear factor in COVID is probably as great, if not greater today than when we started this whole thing, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, Malcolm. I agree with all of that. I think the, a lot of it points to, and I think the listeners will kind of come around to understanding this about me, when I'm not exactly sure of something, I usually don't comment about it. Yeah. When I start to look at something as a thesis, I sort of present it as a thesis that I'm thinking about. And then there's categories of things that I've looked through based on facts, based on assessments of a lot of experts whose judgment I trust and that I'm, you know, very adamant about. I put this pandemic sort of in the second category of something that I'm starting to look at, where I do believe two things, I think, that are likely true. Number one is that this president was succeeding when he was communicating about coronavirus and suffered a bit of a political setback when he stopped doing that. I think there's some degree of assurance that comes from the American people from hearing the president of the United States, who has weighed all of these varying clinical options, economic options, preventative options, vaccine and therapeutic options, and is communicating to the American people about where we are on those things. So I think it's encouraging that he's kind of reinitiated that and is back to communicating with some degree of regularity about it. The other thing is that, you know, we've said over and over again that we've never been through a pandemic this magnitude in our lifetime. Truth is, we've never been through a pandemic this magnitude in a century. And the circumstances in the country 100 years ago were completely different than they are right now. We've now tested 52.9 million Americans. That's like one in six citizens of our country for this particular virus. We had no historical experience about it. It's important to point that out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's also important to point out, I believe, that there is growing anecdotal evidence that these numbers of diagnosed cases and possibly of the fatalities from them are at least modestly inflated. Hmm. Now, why does that really matter? I think it matters because, one, what is the avenue back to normalcy in this country? The avenue back to normalcy is going to be in effective therapeutics and in a vaccine, but also it's going to be on educated, statistical-based decisions on the reopening. And when we have cases, and I'll give you just a few examples here, in Florida, for instance, Orlando Health, vast facility in Central Florida, was under the understanding that they were to be reporting only positive cases. So they were showing like nearly 100% positive tests. Orlando Fox affiliate went in and sort of audited these things, pointed that out, mm-hmm. and they corrected it back to under 10%.
Yeah, I see that.
You know, in Florida also, Lee Memorial Hospital, 100% positive rate. PanCare of Florida, 100% positive rate. Advanced Medical of Naples, 100% positive rate. Also importantly, which has gotten a little bit of attention over the past couple of weeks, is the fact that there is a great degree of, I think, skepticism as it relates to retesting. So ponder for a moment the patient who shows up and is tested in a facility or hospital and is positive. Now, that's not the last test that patient takes or has for the purposes of assessing this. they'll likely be continue to be tested. And there's an operating theory out there that's gaining some momentum that within this category of diagnosed cases, now at 4.2 million, is a considerable number of duplicates. So, and so just, you know, you look at these numbers right now, 4.2 million since this thing started, or I guess generally back in January, some say a little earlier, 2 million of those have fully recovered, very positive. And we have 147,000 plus deaths from it as of this point. Mm-hmm. And the final point statistically is that we are seeing with the testing, and when you test 50 million people, and that number is just going up dramatically with each passing day as testing becomes more easily available, because this president said he would make it available, you're seeing more positive cases, but you're not seeing the exponential growth in the mortality rate. And that, I think, is also encouraging. And the final thing that's really intriguing is that I watched with interest the Pediatric Academy, the association representing pediatricians in this country, come out a few weeks ago and say that they, you know, their clinical recommendation, not opinion, not, you know, politics, but their clinical recommendation was for schools to reopen, that the downside to kids of not being in school was greater than any risk of exposure to a disease that largely is to a virus that is largely not taking lives of younger people. Now, the CDC, within the last week, has come out with that same recommendation. So I think the burden really does fall back on schools to provide some pretty overwhelmingly compelling evidence as to why they're not opening, because you got two really credible institutions there, institutions that are, we rely on for information, that are saying open these schools.
Yeah, the battle of the schools is just starting, actually. And, you know, you're seeing universities, you're seeing schools, Ivy League schools like Harvard, others, and they're doing it all at home now. And a lot of people are dismayed because they're paying the same rates. Now, some schools want to get like a 10% off or something like crazy like that, minimal, you know, because obviously the schools still want the money and to run their programs and operations. But a lot of students and young people are not happy with this because you don't get the same experience by working at home in your living room, you know, in college as you would be in school, right? I mean, that's pretty clear, Michael, you know?
Right.
And they're not happy with it, but a lot of the schools are not going to reopen, and a lot of them have taken this path of trying to do this homeschooling business as well. The school thing is the tip of the iceberg, because there are a lot of communities and a lot of unions and all that are pushing back hard, and they're pushing back to say the health and well-being of the kids is primary important. And of course, the other argument to that is the kids are not jeopardized at all. And then they say, well, they're spreaders of this thing, and they're not really that either, because the data shows that they don't spread it specifically as others say they do. So I think the school thing is it going to be an ongoing fight for those mayors, those school departments, the superintendents, the others who are bent on, for political reasons, holding people back and not opening up schools and playing a precautionary role. And, you know, by golly, I've been talking to physicians all the way through here. And if we did that for every disease, every ailment, every accident prone, every form of life that we were could be jeopardized for, we would never come out of our homes again, Michael. We would be locked in our homes forever. I mean, it's a fool's game. Isn't it a fool's game at this point? It's got to be.
In a sense, I mean, the issue here is that it's new, right? So this is not, so we're comparing it to viruses that have been around for decades, that have been fully vetted and assessed and are understood by, you know, even primary care physicians. You know, this is the Wuhan virus. Mm-hmm. This was created in China, and it left China under very questionable circumstances. And I hope we get to the bottom of that, because I don't see how you look at this any way and say that China doesn't have a vast degree of financial liability for the trillions of dollars in literal and emotional and other damage that they've done.
But let me push back on something. Hold on. Let me push back on something here, because when you talk about, the other viruses, other flus, other types of viruses back, with the some of the earlier coronaviruses, the swine flu, others, when these got out into the public and they were launched, we didn't know much about them at the time either. When these things were new and they hit us, remember the scare back there with the swine flu and all of that that was going on? It was like, oh my God, there's an, and let me just tell you right now, we didn't go to the extreme measures we are going to today, did we, back then when those things were out? We didn't know anything about it.
But, we were, I believe Obama, Biden handled that very poorly. They have nothing to brag about there.
They got away with it.
This is apples and oranges, right? Because the human-to-human transmission among COVID is vastly higher. And it's proving more deadly, in a certain segment of our population and overall. So it's a more serious.
You think it is than the other flus and viruses, you're saying?
Well, on a simply a statistical basis, that's indisputable. I mean, we were geared up on this. Everyone saw the foreign impact that swine flu was having. But, ultimately when it hit the U.S., mm-hmm. There were not many were fatalities that emerged from it.
Yeah.
And the other I think also you, just to circle back on the points you made on education, I think you really raised some very legitimate points. I made this a few months ago myself that if remote and online learning were as effectual mm-hmm. as in the classroom learning, we would have moved to that a long time ago. There's a reason that we bus tens of millions of students into their schoolrooms in a school environment every day. There's a reason that college students largely show up in a classroom as well. And that is that interaction with an instructor in an academic learning setting has been proven to be vastly more effective than remote learning. That's not to say there's not a role for that, particularly maybe right. in some ongoing education, but it would be a big mistake mm-hmm. to kind of fall into this trap that this is six of one, half a dozen of another. It's mm-hmm. night and day. And this last year, students lost a lot, and they've got a lot to catch up on, really, frankly.
They lost a
not
lot.
Not offering them this fall semester in their classrooms is going to be, astronomically greater cost inflicted on them. And the other point is that just on a cost basis, absolutely you're right about that, Malcolm. If we're in a position of charging American citizens a great degree of taxes on a state level predominantly, but also on a federal level to about 10% of total public education costs, and you're not offering the services that you're taxing those people for, where's the refund? And I would hope that we can get some innovative policy leaders and whatnot out in front on that, because to me that's just common sense, and I think it equally applies to collegiate tuition. I mean, if you paid to have in-classroom education and all of a sudden some college and university says, we're not going to offer that,
yeah,
it almost doesn't matter the reason why. The students shouldn't be on the hook for services that they were never provided.
You would think
and
not.
They were due some form of refund for that. And that would be, and that would also have a stimulating effect, I believe, largely on this economy. Because we're looking at, as our Secretary of the Treasury has said, to get money into the hands of people quickly. Well, here's an opportunity to do it in a way that is actually owed to them.
There's a lot of positive things that we've learned from this whole pandemic episode about our education system. And there's probably some good silver linings to come out of it too, because I'll tell you now, there are some more people than ever are homeschooling their children and who will not be sending them back to public education. Because listen, people, one of the biggest problems we're having in this nation is the public government school system, quite frankly, and the indoctrination of Generation Z has been a catastrophe and has actually played to a lot of the civil unrest and the issues we're having from sea to shining sea. So listen, so there are some positive things to come out of this, and it's important to say that, very important. And I got to ask you, Michael, something before we pause here a moment, and it's this. Were you tested? Have you been tested for, you mentioned 1 in 6. Have you been tested yourself?
No symptoms, so I haven't been tested.
Yeah, I have not either. And that's the reason I ask you. I have not either. So we would be 1 in 6, you said earlier, have been tested, right?
1 in 6 have been tested. Over 52 million yeah. Americans presently.
So I wonder,
it's an incredible number, isn't it?
I mean, it is. And the president's been saying that right along. So the question out there to you all is, have you been tested? And, you know, and I think a lot of it comes into, and the reason I bring this up is, it's a lot of this, I think, too, comes back to who we are as a people. How do we live our lives? Do we live our lives in fear? Another, or do we live our lives confidently?
But there's a lack of leadership on our intellectual side of things. And I'm not talking about a lack of presidential leadership, because I think this president's doing a pretty good job. But, you know, we win or lose based on more than just what one person does. It's a culture and it's a movement.
Right.
And one of the reasons I believe that we've even launched this show is to be able to, you know, articulate and speak directly to individuals who I think want to do the right thing, want to push back
Amen.
On socialism, want to push back on some of these radicalized ideas, and are looking for actionable information and a community through which to do it, which makes what you and I are doing, Malcolm, I think incredibly important.
Yeah, that
exciting.
Is well said. Well said. And you know, if you had given me a book, if you wrote a bestseller and you handed it to me with all of the different variables you just discussed, Mike, and I said, hey, here you go, man. See if you can get a publisher for this. I have news for you. The publisher would laugh me right out of their office and say, you are on some sort of drug here, Mr. Malcolm. But that is what we're faced with. Sometimes the reality is a reality. It's hard to believe sometimes, isn't it, people, you know? Well, listen, you are listening to Viewpoint Presents with Malcolm and Michael Johns. And this is the inaugural program here. We're excited, happy you're here with us on the journey here. As we launch this, as Michael was just saying, to really change the false narratives out there and to bring the out loud truth to the airwaves is so vitally important, my friends, for us as Americans and for us patriots who are so desperate for truth and just really want what's right in the world. We're not looking for anything more than just the truth, and the truth isn't always sugar-coated. The truth is the truth. It can hurt, my friends, and it is what it is, isn't it now? But it's what we do with that truth, and it's how we move forward from that standpoint that makes the ultimate difference. So, with Viewpoint Presents now, the program you will hear every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. It's the second hour of Viewpoint, right after Viewpoint this Sunday, which you've been listening for the last 2.5 years now, we're proudly to say. And we need you to help us share the good word and get this show out there from, say it to me in unison, if you would, sea to shine and see. And even beyond sea to shine and see around the world and the globe as well. We do have a global audience here at America Out Loud, but certainly within our seas and our shining seas, we want them to shine bright for all of us and for all the world to see. That's the motive and the agenda here. So again, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, Viewpoint Presents, right after Viewpoint this Sunday is the second hour. And there's an encore later in the day, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Eastern Seaboard. You can catch that show. Just do the math on the if you're on the West Coast, okay? You know that would be 7 in the morning instead of 10 for Viewpoint this Sunday, or it would be 8 and 11. Just do the math, 3 hours there, of course. We're excited you're here. All the shows go to podcast. You'll catch them right at AmericaOutLoud.com, as well as Viewpoint Presents here. You'll get that on podcast Sunday afternoon. Please look for just after 2 o'clock time zone here on the Eastern Seaboard. You'll get it on podcast networks worldwide and on the front page of America Out Loud. We thank you, friends, for being with us. We're going to continue on, talk about election 2020, China, a whole lot more here on Viewpoint Presents. We'll pause and be back in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health. sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
American Democracy in Action. Viewpoint presents Election 2020.
This is no small election, by the way, if you haven't been paying attention here, and it is right now in front of us. And it's a different kind of election because, as we just talked about in the first segment, you're not going to have your typical conventions. You're not going to have a lot of your typical push and promote and rallies and things. Now, hopefully there will be some. And Michael, as we open back up here, I think a lot of that's going to depend on where these numbers go and if the president, because they kind of put him in the corner a little bit or against the wall almost. And I'm talking about the entire Washington and the media elite, with daring the president to do his rallies and do his thing because they keep pushing the COVID, which really brings me to the whole point of this election being politicized to the degree that we've never seen one that's going to be politicized in the next few months between two things, Michael. It's going to be between COVID, Corona, China virus, and the civil unrest in America's cities. There's the path right there. And I think we're in for some historical stories and points of interest in these next 3 months before the election.
Yeah, if I go back to the fall and I look how the president had this kind of lined up in a way as far as what his case would be for reelection. And it was based, I think, predominantly on the fact that he had promised great turnaround in what was an incredibly stagnant, go-nowhere economy for 8 years under Obama and Biden. And he had more Americans working than any time in the history of the country. Historical low unemployment in minority demographics, wages starting to rise for the first time in a decade or more, key growth in construction and other industries that had really been hit hard, and a sense of consumer confidence that was, really beginning to skyrocket. And what a curveball we've been thrown here, because I do believe politics is about the present. I think it's very difficult to say, yeah, but I did in a past tense. It's what are you doing? And you correctly pointed out in our first segment that, these issues are, this is going to be an assessment of are we pulling out of this coronavirus, or is this thing getting worse? Is the president managing it competently or not? And then as it relates to the street violence, I guess voters are going to have to look at that and say if that's something that they want to be affiliated with, because Biden has no criticism, as far as I can tell, for any of these tactics, for the Marxist ideology of the leaders of the movements that are driving it, for the outrageous, almost incredibly unbelievable positions that they've taken on a vast number of things. Yeah. This really has almost nothing to do with what it started out to be. And, I guess in that category of, hey, you got to think about things, but you do have to think about kind of the origins of these two crises. One, we know it originated in China, and we're not exactly sure of the circumstances, but it seems to me pretty compelling that you could make an argument that the Communist Party of China and Xi Jinping basically made a conscious decision to allow this virus out of the country. I would be welcome in hearing and intrigued to hear any alternative argument to that, because they, and the evidence of it is that they constrained it within the province. They didn't allow those people to leave. Right. They knew it was that the transmittability was that high, and yet they allowed people to fly out of the province all over the world, including the United States.
Yeah, the word that comes to my mind is weaponized. I mean, they weaponized this. Listen, you know, we can argue all day long about where it came from, the virus lab or some seafood market. And I know I got my own thoughts, which I've shared with listeners on my weekly program, where it comes from. But the bigger point is they weaponized the virus and they've maximized to create opportunities, which I've pointed out here on Viewpoint to the nth degree. And, you know, never let, well, they have the same motto, if you think about it, Michael, that the Democrat
why are we not talking more about that? I mean, I think, you know, part of involvement that I've had, you know, having been inside the Beltway, working at institutions and in the federal government, including the White House, is the way you look at the world when you're there and then the way you look at the world when you're in a grassroots leadership movement, as I've been as a co-founder and leader of our Tea Party movement, is that I think when you're outside, you kind of look in with curiosity about why certain things are not being talked more about and why certain things that don't seem so important are being talked about so much. One of the questions I have is that, you know, in essence, this is almost, you know, indistinguishable from a declaration of war. I mean, if it played out as you and I are saying is highly likely, not definitively proven, I guess. I mean, I think we're going to need that sort of affirmation, but I think every indication suggests that's what's happened here. What's the difference between what they just did and literally a biological or chemical attack on the country that would have taken tens of thousands of lives? I mean, it just seems to me, the president said it, that China holds responsibility. Our Secretary of State has said China holds responsibility. I believe most of Congress that I've heard, including members of both parties, have said China holds responsibility. Why is the fact that they are responsible for this unbelievable amount of pain, agony, death, and sickness not being part of the daily dialogue or news cycle in this country? It's a big question to me.
Well, it comes to the point that what I think you're really asking is why aren't we united as Americans against that? Because if you look historically at things that have tried to come against us, Michael, as a country, as a people, whatever it might be, whether it's a world war, whether it's a 9/11 event or some casualty sort of program, Pearl Harbor, whatever it is, the country under great duress came together. But we're not seeing that now. Does that make this a little more interesting of a moment historically for us, do you think?
Well, it does, because I mean, we're trying to address two major challenges or current events in the country, and we're also trying to look at it from the standpoint, understandably, of what the impact's going to be on November 3. And I guess what I'm getting at is I think we have two serious crises here in coronavirus and the street riots, both of which appear to not be accidental. They appear to be coordinated. They appear to be designed to damage this president politically. And yet I'm not, and when I say there's a lack of leadership on our side, by that I mean that I am not hearing or seeing the leadership on these two crises that I think are warranted on our side, but I'm also not hearing articulated what I just articulated, is that we have really good reason to believe that both of these things are in essence potential political creations, not at all coincidental, not at all accidental, consciously designed to leave Wuhan, to infect Americans, and to bring down the economy of our country and the public health threat of our country and the popularity of our president, and street riots that clearly are being well-funded, coordinated, I mean, it's not even a secret, radicalized and presenting, a threat to urban life. And all of that, of course, changes the conversations that we're having in the country, because you and I could just as easily be sitting here and talking about the miraculous, you know, Trump recovery and economy, the greatest job creator in the history of the country, the president who got us out of horrific agreements like Iran agreement and the Paris agreement, who is restoring, you know, American pride and even unity. Race relations, by the way, as recently as last fall, were perceived by Americans to be better under Trump's watch than they were under Obama and Biden's. And now I think we're going to confront a campaign where we have a whole recreation of 8 very sort of unremarkable, dismal years that did very little for the people that the Hope and Change campaign of 2008 promised.
I am so glad to hear you say what you said a few moments ago when you connected the dots about everything that's happening now and that these are political tools, to hear you say what you said. And I'm glad listeners were here to hear you say it, and I'll tell you why. Because, and let me just tell folks out there now, because bottom line is, Michael deals with facts and data. That's why actually we make a very good team. I tend to push more of the narrative of what I find my truth is out there based on the information. And I'm not afraid ever to give an opinion quickly, which is where I got my name out loud from. But Michael deals with facts and data as a big thinker, but a strategist and a person of consequence, I think, who is very careful in choosing his words. So I say that because, Michael, there are a lot of people out there who throw these things around, especially on social media. They're very cavalier about all of it, and it becomes a joke or it becomes a sideline to get likes and followers. I never, ever, ever see you do that on any level, because you are a responsible analyst, commentator, journalist, all of it wrapped up into one. So for you to say what you say just now, that should be, everybody should have listened to that and said, well, if Michael's saying that, there's something to it. Does that make sense?
I hope it does. And I think I put it out there as a studied thesis. It's kind of my leading thesis as far as what's going on, but it's important because I think one of the questions, as you said, leading into this, that we're going to be asking ourselves over the next few months between now and November 3rd is, who's responsible for all this damage that this pandemic has created? Hmm. Well, right now in the country, we're debating this in a very isolated way. Is Trump doing the right thing? Is he doing the wrong thing? You know, and I think you've heard me say, I believe he's handled this pretty remarkably well. No one's saying, the anger is not being directed, as it should be, in my view, at China and the Communist Party of China specifically, which, in my view, based on everything that we've been able to see, consciously launched this global attack on the people of the world and on the economies of the world, with a particular impact on our own country. So that kind of answers the question. When you say who's responsible for the pandemic, it's not Trump, it's not Biden, it's China. And when you look at what's going on in the streets and say who's responsible for that, there too, it's so nauseating to me to hear the leaders of that movement try to develop themselves as some sort of anti-Trump movement when it was Trump, not Biden, who launched the first major criminal justice reform legislation in this country that had a very significant impact on many African Americans in our criminal processes and who were incarcerated. It was Donald Trump, not Biden and Obama, who had African American employment at all-time highs and wages at all-time highs. And it was, as I just said, Donald Trump, not Obama and Biden, who was beginning to make some progress in race relations in this country. Obama was always one of those guys who, you know, he would very carefully drop these race-based explosive devices on the American people, designed ultimately to divide. And the one thing I've noticed in American politics, particularly over the last decade, is those people that are most aggressive in accusing others of being divisive are usually the divisive ones themselves. And I think this president has endeavored from day one to try to unite. He very quickly saw the limitations of the ability to do that with a Democrat Party and media that had no interest in working together or in progress or even in factual recognition of what's going on in the world. And now we got these two crises going on. And I believe none of the fingers of blame point to this president, but they do point to ominous forces in our country and in our world that need to be unveiled, you know?
Yeah. And then you have to ask yourself, okay, so, but then why isn't the country coming together? Why aren't we uniting on some level to what Michael says right there and pointing out, like China in that particular case or others, And what this should tell every American right now, as we get ready for this pivotal major election in our history, is that the forces to be here back at home, and the Democrat Party and the Republican Party, it is completely a political tool. The Democrat Party has made the decision. They are willing to gamble, really, truly gamble. And it is a gamble, people. If you think about it in the right context of what we're speaking about right now. So they are gambling America's future and where we stand right now and thinking about it in that way, because they see this as a political opportunity to use the COVID pandemic problem and the civil unrest in all of these major cities as a major 1-2 punch. And they are indeed blaming it, the president. And how do I know that? Well, because one of the leading Democrat leaders, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, she now calls it the Trump virus, trying to pin this on Trump. You just can't make this stuff up, I have to tell you. It's pretty wild. So Michael's point there about this is significant, is all I'm saying to you. And there's your reason. So it's an eye-opener. I just preface this a moment to slow it down so you get what I'm talking about. This should be an awakening call to every American to understand what's really the value here. What's the risk? What's the value? And how are we using this? For what purpose? And if your purpose is just to seize power and to hit the other opposing party just because you can, well, that's pretty sick. And at what cost, you ask, right? Well, there's your cost. Well, this should be a rude awakening to all of you out there, everybody. And again, but, you know, I plead with all of you, we've got to reach across the aisle. We've got to get those moderates, independents, and left of center. I'm telling you, we're going to get Americans, not extremists. We don't need everybody in the boat, but we do need real Americans, left, right, and center, that are willing to save this nation for what it is. And it's an important moment to understand that. So it's 2 hours of viewpoint now. You'll get between 10 and noontime. Look at it that way, between 10 a.m. and noontime every Sunday. And also we'll come back to you later in the day between 6 and 8. That's a good way to look at it. Easy to remember that, right? So try to, you know, schedule us in your schedule, your planner. Bookmark us, if you would. And be with us and enjoy. Have coffee with us on Sunday morning between 10 and 12. And if you miss us there because something's going on, then come back at 6 and 8 and join us there. All the program will go to podcast as well in America Out Loud. But listen, we got our sleeves rolled up here, and we are ready for the battle ahead. I hope you are out there as well with us. We plan on taking a firm stand to take America back. More Viewpoint Presents in just a moment. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. As we celebrate our four-year anniversary, thank you for making it all possible. Well, shouldn't news deliver truth and inspire us to reach higher? With blogs, podcasts, video, and 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
You know, Malcolm, I mean, you had mentioned, I think, something really politically and significant from a policy standpoint, and that is, you know, the motives behind some on the far left, including elected leaders in the management of coronavirus. And I think we give most politicians maybe the benefit of the doubt, I think, here, that they're trying to contain this, that they're not envisioning any political benefit from destroying their state's economy or from seeing the pandemic spread. And yet I was really unbelievably moved by this comment by Jim Clyburn, who is one of the part of the House leadership, one of Nancy Pelosi's top deputies, and very much involved in communicating what the Democrat position is at any given moment. He, talking about the coronavirus, said that it was a, quote, tremendous opportunity to restructure things, unquote. And I think most Americans look at this and say, well, gee, it's a great opportunity to get our arms around this pandemic and put it to rest and get back to normalcy in our lives. But yeah. You can see within that quote that at least some have let slip that this is a political opportunity and a political moment for them that kind of lies on the old Democrat adage that you don't let any crises go to waste, as Rahm Emanuel famously said once.
Yeah, they are looking for a new normal. Remember, we keep hearing the words, Michael, new normal, you know, and that's their new normal. See, they see a different version of America, which you hinted at in the first program. You actually hit it out of the park in saying that it really is about a socialism move. And I'll even go one step further for you. I think this is a Marxist move right now. This is pretty dangerous stuff, what's happening in our nation right now. And make no mistake about it, is the Democrat operative multi-mainstream media message together is that peaceful protest and Black Lives Matter. Well, there are no peaceful protests, and there is a real kickback against any lives matter. It's become a political firestorm everywhere when you talk into this. And I think this is really here, and I want to point a couple things out to you, Michael, and get your opinion, and here they are. I mentioned in the first hour viewpoint today on this, and we played a very interesting audio clip from a video that was entitled this, Can COVID-19 Beat Populism? And this was from an Israeli paper that was showcasing an official Chinese media a video and a message, if you will. And here's what I want to tell people now. And what do you think of this, Michael? It's the Chinese Communist Party now, they say, has increasingly had problems with the nationalistic leaders such as Trump, Johnson, Boris Johnson they're speaking about, and Bolsonaro they're talking about as well. And these three and others have recognized China's growing threat to Western dominance. And so President Trump was seen by much of the U.S. as having stood up effectively against the Chinese dragon and prepared to coast smoothly to a second term, they say here. Well, the virus, whether developed on purpose for this very moment or used proactively once it began, which is an interesting way of what you said earlier, Michael, right, about the virus. We don't really know, but okay, there it is. To spread has been the single greatest tool of the CCP, China Communist Party, in its attempt to wreck and wreak havoc on the West and bring it to its knees. The CCP wants to use the pandemic to ensure President Trump loses and bring in a compliant U.S. government as it had under the Obama administration. This is the plan. However, as we know, plans don't always go as smoothly as envisioned, the Israeli paper said. Don't you find that commentary very interesting, Michael?
I do generally agree with it as well. I think, you know, the Chinese Communist Party stands for everything the American people oppose. They are also the most calculating, intelligent, long-range thinkers, I think, of any leadership in the world. I think I can simultaneously say that I admire and despise the leadership of that country. I mean, because the things they've been able to pull off, like the issue we just talked about, without even really a whole lot of scrutiny or calls for accountability, are incredible to me. And the double standards are incredible. Now, a lot of people say, you know, that human rights in foreign countries is not really the business of the American people. I've always been a champion of human rights. I believe that we should, as leaders of the free world, do everything we can to encourage them throughout the world. And, you know, if you start looking at the things that have been going on in China, I mean, since Mao, but intensively and increasingly under this current leadership there, ripping of you know, organ harvesting of Uyghur dissidents, the clampdown in Hong Kong, the one-child policy, and restricting and, you know, ripping unborn children out of women's wombs, and some of the most absolutely appalling human rights practices you could envision. People just disappearing off the street, including people who tried to talk the truth about this coronavirus in China very early on, still not accounted for. The logical follow-up question is, well, if that's all China's business and that's not our business, what else is that regime capable or willing to do? And it's one of the reasons that neglect of some of these circumstances can be detrimental, because the answer to the question is what wouldn't they do is apparently not, is not a big category of things. They seem pretty willing to do very daring things, very bold things, and very detrimental things. They've manipulated international institutions that we've come to rely on, which is one of the reasons I believe that we have such a great and growing and probably justified skepticism of the United Nations, the World Health Organization, which we've now pulled out of, the UN Human Rights Council, which we've also pulled out of, which incredibly China is a part of. I mean, just ponder the absurdity of putting one of the world's worst human rights abusers on the Human Rights Council to assess the human rights conditions of countries like our own. That's ridiculous. And they have sort of navigated this system, and they are doing it with very complicated and complex schemes that, you know, that really require a lot of attentiveness by American policy leaders and the American people to understand. One of which is this global Belt and Road Initiative that they launched in 2013, which is, in my judgment, one of the more threatening things going on in the world right now. They're putting countries in Africa, Latin America, South Asia in great degrees of debt to finance their own development initiatives and to build very self-centered trade relationships for what amounts to like 70 countries of the world, you know, when well over close to 2/3 of the world's population. No one's paying much attention to it, but it is getting attention in Africa and Latin America, where they're starting to push back on it. So you mentioned Bolsonaro in Brazil. I mean, who is a populist? He kind of, I do think correctly, have to put him in that category. He's pushed back on a lot of these things. I think Boris Johnson understands it. The Brexit initiative, along with the Trump election, both of which happened roughly simultaneously, were two of the biggest, boldest kind of manifestations of Tea Party sentiment globally in the last few years, and a sign that that's not letting up. I mean, I remember when people started first asking me about the global implications of the Tea Party movement and whether populism that was getting all this attention globally of what we were doing in the U.S. would actually, you know, have a monumental effect, and you do see it. I mean, Britain's not the only country that wants out of the EU. I mean, you can find movements in every European country that feels are being ill-served by that, and they want out of it. They feel it's an exploitive relationship. They feel it's essentially an undemocratic institution, that their viewpoints aren't being represented or considered, and that their cost to their country is considerable. And all around the world, you have, a rebellion against heavy-handed governments like the one in communist China, that is trying to reshape the world in their image. And they see one country standing in the way of global domination, and that's the United States of America, and one political leader, that's Donald Trump.
Yeah, that is so accurate there. I mean, wow, that is well said. We are, interestingly, with Trump and China, the way I would say it is this: what he did, what President Trump did, is he stopped off a Chinese takeover. He delayed it. He pushed it back. They were on the move. And clearly there have been, a lot of this has been thought out much prior to what we're dealing. Right now you see the burning of the documents at the Houston consulate there. Yep. You see the San Francisco person that was arrested there in that consulate. You see, as I told folks earlier, we have one embassy in China there, and we have five consulates in the United States, China has, as I recall, and they're all hotspots for theft and spying on the highest level. Well, of course, China reciprocates. So what we're dealing right now is, just think of it in these terms. If Trump hadn't come along, if he hadn't push them back from the lack of leadership over the last 30 years of administrations given into China and them taking advantage of gutting out our pharmaceuticals and our manufacturing and our energy industries and gutting us out, we really, I would say to you, Michael, had really become over many, many years, I don't know if you like to said this way or not, but really China's bitch. And now finally, President Trump came along and said, I'm not going to have that anymore. He stood up to the dragon, and the dragon does not like it. And now we've got the dragon kicking back with all of this nonsense going on. In fact, we reported earlier in the other hour of the program as well, how they are even behind some of the Antifa and Black Lives Matter movement. Intelligence is showing us out of Houston, and some of that stuff they're burning there relates to that intelligence, people are saying. So listen, this is a moment in time, this China business, and this is only the very tip of this dragon conversation. We'll be having a lot more ahead in the weeks and months ahead as we are here. So, Michael, last moment or two left. We've covered a lot of great conversation, great talk, great dialogue here on this inaugural program. Tell listeners what you would like to see as we launch this thing now into the stratosphere, what your goal is over the next many months here.
Well, firstly, I'm really proud and enthusiastic about the partnership that we've been able to build, and I think very similar vision for what this program can ultimately serve. There's no shortage of information out there, and obviously there's, you know, lots of broadcasts here and there, and you can hear people shouting their opinions and whatnot. My vision politically and from a policy standpoint and from a patriotic standpoint has always been to try to build a large community of Americans who understand in great detail, actually, the threats that we confront. For instance, on China, it's not just what China's been doing, but it's the managed decline philosophy, which most Americans haven't even heard about, that, you know, has guided China policy for a while. This thesis that we inevitably need to transfer peacefully American power to China. We've had people in our own government who believe that to be the case. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all of the threats that we face, all the confrontations, so all many. The challenges, we need educated citizens who are going to work together and collaborate. And so this is hopefully not a one-way conversation. I hope it'll be a two-way conversation. I hope that, you know, listeners will reach out and communicate with us and, you know, keep us posted on things that are concerning to them, that they're noticing in their own communities, and the ideas and thoughts that they have on how we can maintain and strengthen American Constitution and Republic and American strength at home and abroad.
Well, welcome aboard, my friend and colleague here, Michael Johns, to Viewpoint. And Michael has said repeatedly to me in past weeks and months about the community. And I really like what he says, because he has been driving and planting the seed with me about, Malcolm, what we really need is a community here. We need a community of passionate patriots and conservative people who really love their country, who want to get behind it. So, friends, consider this your invitation, your opportunity to be part of something bigger, and an opportunity here at Viewpoint and America Out Loud. And welcome and thank you, as always, for being with me here on the journey. It's time to get involved and get loud.